ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Sky Kirkham and welcome to The Art Show on Radio National Summer, where I'm bringing you some of our best conversations from across the year. Later this hour, Michael Doe will take us to Mona in Tasmania, where drops of molten steel drip from the ceiling in a shower of light as part of an exhibition by the Italian sculptor Arcangelo Sassolino. And art writer Quinton Sprague will take us behind the scenes to discover how artists see. But first, Daniel Browning meets up with Joanne Sullivan and Ursula Strumpf as they celebrate the 20th anniversary of their gallery's first opening.
They used to lay by contemporary art back in the day, forging a business relationship early on. What's even more surprising is that after 20 years in the commercial gallery business, they're still friends. They're also one of Australia's most successful art partnerships. I don't mean in terms of profit-making or business revenue, although they're very canny businesswomen. I'm talking about the cultural impact of the artists they represent. And some of those include Tony Albert, Lindy Lee, Polly Borland, XD Medici, Sam Leach, Ramesh Marionithyendran, Yvette Coppersmith and Naminapu Mamoru White. Ursula Sullivan and Joanna Strumpf are now key players in the commercial gallery sector. They shook things up when they first arrived on the scene in 2005, when both Sydney and Melbourne were proverbial one-horse towns, to become a permanent fixture and a positive influence in the arts ecology. Ursula Sullivan and Joanna Strumpf, welcome to The Art Show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
How did you both meet?
Well, way back in the dark
way back
ages,
in school.
In 1996. Joe?
Well, I went to university in Brisbane. And
which university, by the way?
I went to the University of Queensland, where I studied
me
art.
Me too.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. What year?
Oh, I graduated in 97.
Oh, my God. 97. So much younger than me.
And I was advised when I said at the age of 15 that I wanted to be an art dealer that I needed to study art history and French. And so that's exactly what I did, except I was terrible at French. So I gave that up after the first year. But I stayed with the art history. Mm. And then when I graduated, there was really only one gallery in Brisbane that I wanted to work for. And he didn't have any jobs for me. So I moved to Sydney.
For no other reason, there were just no jobs.
And on a very fateful weekend, I found a really great place to live. And then the next day, I walked around the streets clutching my CV, and I happened to walk into a gallery where the main gallery assistant had just handed in her resignation, and the very desperate art dealer said, quickly, come, how soon can you start? And I said, absolutely immediately, which I did. And then I think maybe like 2 days later, this girl walked through the door who looked after the gallery on Sundays to say goodbye to the girl whose job I was taking. And that was Ursula Sullivan, Ursula J. Sullivan.
And what did you think when you met Jo?
I thought she was great.
She's taking my friend's job.
Yeah, I just thought, here we go. Because, I mean, the dealer that we were working for was fabulous because she gave a lot of people a chance in the art world who had pretty pitiful CVs. Mm. But she was also a little tricky to work with as well. So there was a bit of a turnover of staff there. And so it was like, oh, here's the next one. And, and you know, she'd moved from Brisbane and I had come from Brisbane as well. And so we didn't really connect over that, actually.
Oh, really?
But very quickly, our friend Verity, who was the one leaving, Joe and I became sort of quite a tight sort of trio of close friends because we had this sort of work experience to share and everything else to share as well. So within that first week of Jo moving to Sydney, she met her two future best friends and also her husband. So it was quite a big week.
Who was in the share house in Paddington?
Yeah.
God. It's like an episode of I'm thinking Melrose Place, but no. Something a bit more upmarket.
It was more like Girls than Melrose Place, let me tell you.
So then what happened there? I mean, how long did you stay at that particular gallery?
I was only there for 6 months and I got kind of...
got jack of it?
Pinched. No, I got headhunted by another art dealer and Ursula then had finished her university, so she took my role at that same gallery. And so for a while we were head-to-head. So I was working for the rival art dealer, and there's a beautiful story where we went on our Easter holidays as became a tradition, actually, and we sort of still do it today, although we skip the odd year here and there. And we took a house down the south coast, and Urs happened to arrive first. I came a little bit later in a different car, and she ran down to the car to greet me, and she said, "There's three Olsons here."
As in three members of the Olsen family, or three
Olsen
paintings?
No, three Olsen paintings.
Okay.
Yes.
In the holiday house that we were renting.
Wow.
And so there was a bit of a battle royale over whose boss was able to acquire these Olsons and then sell them in the gallery.
I was deeply insulted because I lost. And I do like to win. So
So then when did the idea come that you would form a company, form a gallery together?
It was there pretty early, to be honest. We used to answer the phone to each other, Sullivan's from Fine Art, Ursula speaking, and it was a joke.
You manifested.
But also,
you made it real.
Also, totally. We were kind of quite deeply serious about it as well, but we just didn't really know how to get there. And so we started buying contemporary art together. Like within 6 months of meeting, I mean, I think we were like 21, 22 years old, we started lay-buying artworks from the contemporary dealers at the same time because we just loved contemporary art. Like it really comes from a place of love of contemporary art. And it's really hard to buy contemporary art when you're on, you know, the pittance wages that arts people get. And so we decided we'd buy artwork together and do these long, torturous lay-bys for the art dealers involved.
How long was the longest lay-by?
Over a year. And Darren Knight was particularly
he was
good
amazing.
With us. Yeah. And we didn't have credit cards or even checkbooks at that stage.
We used to do money orders.
From the post office.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It was
old school.
Because you used to be able to buy money orders, didn't you? Like, here's a money order for $100. And you've had to sign for it a bit? No. You just buy the money order.
You'd buy the money order and then
you could
send
post
it off
it
to poor
legally.
Darren.
Yeah.
And he would credit that and be like, oh, one day you'll finish the pain.
Do you remember the artwork that was the longest, subject of the longest lay-by?
I think it was the Anne Wallace. And it actually won the Sulman Prize, right?
Yeah. We bought it. We bought it like the night before
love
the judging.
Love
yeah,
Antwerp.
Yeah, she is great.
Yeah. She actually went to the same school that I went to, and I remember seeing her artwork hanging in the art room at school and thinking, that's amazing.
Crazy.
I know, right?
Crazy.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting thing. I mean, you didn't connect over Brisbane.
Mm-mm.
We always say we would have hated each other if we'd known
at
each other.
At school.
I was very dark and moody, grumpy teenager, whereas Joe was a bit more sort of musical girl.
Musical kid, goody two shoes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we wouldn't have bonded.
No.
I've had the pleasure of working with you both and have written for the magazine. And I've worked with you, you know, kind of unofficially over the years because of my friendship and collaboration with Tony Albert. Talking about artists like Tony Albert, you know, you've got on the roster some incredible practitioners who are important people in the scene. But they're also voices. I think of them as being voices in public discourse as well. How do you determine who you're going to... Who are you going to welcome in to the family? I mean, how do you decide?
It's very instinctual and nuanced, and there is
and is
no
it always,
recipe.
Is it always unanimous?
Not really.
Always.
I love the unison there.
No, it's not always unanimous, but that's okay. You don't have to agree on everything because sometimes if you have to agree on everything, then everything is compromised. Whereas if either Joe or I feel really strongly about something, we have the freedom in our relationship to respect that of each other and to then let that happen. And quite often we will learn a lot for doing that. And we both have experiences each way. And you know, for example, Greg Hodge, who is like the most amazing artist now, I did not back him at first. I just thought, too decorative. And then his evolution, and Joe was like, nope, we're doing it. But his evolution has been truly incredible as a painter and as an artist and as a human being, actually. And so I was wrong. I mean, I have been right a lot of times. But
and there are many instances where I was completely wrong and Ursula was completely on track. So, yeah, it's great that we
can... Are there any examples, Jo?
None that are coming to mind. I'm sure that
How do you maintain a friendship? Because, you know, a business can be brutal. How do you maintain what appears to me to be still a good friendship?
We just have a lot of fun, you know. She makes me laugh.
Yeah, we're very honest with each other.
And we share an office as well, so it's
that makes no difference. People who share offices can hate each other.
No, we don't. We just have fun and we're eternally grateful to have the other person there because it's a really hard business. Mm-hmm. You know, it looks like a lot of glamour and a lot of champagne, but it's a hard slog. And we repeatedly say, oh my God, I don't know how you could do this by yourself without the support. Because I've got her back. She's got my back.
We have the same agenda. There's no competing agendas with what we're doing. We both want the best for our artists. We both want the best for the gallery. And so we keep that in mind at all times. And we trust that the other person has that. Mm. You know, I think actually the fact that we were buying artworks together, which involves money, was really healthy way for us to start because it established that trust, the business trust. And even though we started with just simply buying artwork because we love it, it did give us the trust of our relationship. And I moved to Melbourne and so there was the distance and then we could still make things work in that way. So, yeah, I mean, trust is so important with everything that we do, with our artists, but especially with each other. And you can't put a price on it. It is just so important. And I trust Joe with everything. And she does me too. So it's very like we've got the same goals, we trust each other and that's it. And nothing can break that.
So who's I mean, Tony, I mentioned just as because we're so close. But seeing his career and the way that you've managed that, and I take that to be an example of how you've supported your artists.
Tony's a fantastic example.
He's a workhorse, that guy.
He's an amazing example of a human being and what's achievable as a human being and as an artist. It's really important that artists have freedom to develop and progress and think, and we really respect that need for an artist to do it, to do that, to do those things. So, yeah, we definitely encourage that, all of those things. I mean, there's a lot of cowboys in the world, and so we try to, as best we can, to protect an artist from that element. But aside from that, there's, yeah, freedom. That's art.
And cowboys, you're talking about other gallerists or the industry as a whole?
In the industry as a whole. Yeah.
Whose career are you most proud of over the last 20 years? I mean, is there one artist you supported the whole time over that stretch of 20 years that you've been with, that's been with you?
I think Sid's a great example.
So we're just about to open an exhibition on Saturday, which is Sydney Ball. And while we certainly weren't with him his entire career, I mean, he was 83 when he passed away in 2017, he was with us from the beginning in 2005.
From the beginning of Sullivan and Strumpf.
From the beginning of Sullivan and Strumpf. And he was a great artist. I mean, his work was in all of the major collections throughout the country, but he'd kind of, I guess, was in a bit of a quiet patch. And he came to us on a mix of a good word from a friend and also because he liked the font that we were using on the outside of the gallery.
I'm sorry, that's really important. Mm. You know, the aesthetics of your, you know, how you represent yourself is really important. An artist would see that.
We are all visual, right? Mm. So Sid liked our font and and we went to visit him in his glorious Glenmorcott house in the Hills District, and we took barbecue chicken, and you know, it was just the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And what I love about Sid is that I mean, he was our mentor, really. He was like the grandfather of the gallery. He taught us so much about how to do things, what to do, what not to do. And at the same time, he was really enlivened by his involvement with the younger artists that we were showing. He was, you know, regularly coming and seeing what everyone was doing. There were beautiful friendships. Michael Lindemann, who's another one of our great artists, became quite close with Sid and would go and, you know, clean his gutters and help him do these things that, you know, help him stretch canvases and put things together. Oh. It was really beautiful. And he passed away, and you know, I was with him in his, you know, sort of last day at the hospital. And I guess the way that his work developed in the time that he was with us is really exciting too. And we've actually got an exhibition that is just that period, just the Sullivan and Strumpf years of Sid Ball, and it's glorious. It's so good to see it up again.
What are you guys as predictors and as, you know, trendsetters, agenda setters? What are you seeing? What's the most exciting kind of, I guess, through line or current in art practice, and who are the artists who are doing it? Big call.
Well, we just had a show in our Melbourne gallery called In My Prime, and we just took on a really young artist by the name of Jess Cochran. So she's at the very beginning. Mm. We haven't even had a solo show yet. There's one early next year. She's really exciting. That's just going to be a great story.
Straight out of university or what?
No. She's had maybe 10 years out of university. She's based in London, but she's Australian.
I'm showing my appalling lack of knowledge.
No one knows about her. So that's the starting story. Mm-hmm. Then there's someone like, for example, Sam Leach, who came with us very early on, and his involvement and interest in the whole AI evolution has just kind of sustained him and been able to elevate his practice in a way that's really beautiful. You know, we're just about to have the first solo show of Gemma Smith, who's very established in Australia. You know, she used to show with Sarah Cotier, for example, in Sydney. And so that's really exciting. I mean, she's just made the most incredible, huge works that we showed at Art Basel Hong Kong as well. So, you know, a lot of the artists are doing really special things that are unique to their own practice. And whether or not that's someone starting off, Jess Cochran, or someone who's established, Sam and Gemma, or someone who's no longer alive, like Sid Ball. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's just a lot of things going on, a lot of balls in the air for all of the artists. And it's really exciting to watch, actually, just as a gallerist, to see someone hitting these high notes. It's just beautiful.
Hey, look, congratulations on your 20 years.
Thank you.
And will there be another 20 years? Because you met someone recently who has 40 years, a collaboration business that's lasted as long, as twice as long as you.
Maybe.
Let's see.
We might be very tired.
Joanne Sullivan and Ursula Strumpf there. Their gallery turned 20 years old this year and continues to be a vital part of the Australian art scene. They were speaking with Daniel Browning. You're listening to The Art Show on Radio National Summer. I'm Sky Kirkham, and coming up next, Michael Doe meets an artist who pushes objects to their breaking point and beyond, and whose Australian exhibition involves molten metal dripping from the ceiling in bursts of heat and light. The Italian sculptor Arcangelo Sassolino.
Art often lives in the in-between. It holds multiple meanings, sometimes in harmony, sometimes in tension. A single work can often feel both dangerous and safe, grounded and experimental, or even fragile yet enduring. and artists invite us into these contradictions. Arcangelo Sassolino is one of these artists. His work captures a suspended instant just before collapse, just after ignition. He takes machines and liberates them from their purpose, finding poetry in motion, philosophy in pressure. At the 2022 Venice Biennale, Sassolino paid homage to Caravaggio's beheading of St. John the Baptist. But where Caravaggio painted light and shadow, Sassolino sculpts with fire and steel, molten light heated to 1500 degrees, falling from above into dark pools of water, light emerging from darkness. His latest exhibition at MoNA, In the End, The Beginning, brings this work and others to Australia. Arcangelo, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's my first exhibition in Australia, and it's very special to be here.
And Arcangelo, I mean, molten steel isn't exactly a beginner's material. It's violent, unpredictable, and dangerous. It's also quite logistically complex. So can you tell us a little bit about the work and how you started to work with a material so volatile and elemental?
Before you say, you talk about the contradiction life, and life for me is something that is wonderful and absurd, amazing, and full of fragility and not stay. So over the years, I start working with something that is not stable. I like the instability of the work. Mm-hmm. And working with molten steel is something that can work only for a few seconds. It's not something that stay. We're used to see throughout the art history, you know, pieces made of steel. But all the steel, everything that is steel, it can be the ring that is in our finger, or a bullet that someplace is killing someone, or a bisturi that is saving someone. Before being what it is, it was before melted steel. As it happened in philosophy, try to find a through by going back into the change of knowledge. And showing melted steel, for me, is a way of talking about instability. It's talking about something that cannot stay there. That is why I keep have to have like this, like a falling of a drop of molten steel. The other thing is that in order to melt a steel, you have to put energy inside the material. And that energy became light. When we present the pavilion at the Venice Biennial, for me, you try to talk about Caravaggio, is easy to be rhetoric. So I thought that the only way to say something that makes sense with a giant of the art history like him was to present a new light. And melted steel, when is a 1500 degree, it became like a new light in a sense. And what we are doing here at the MoNA, however, is something different. What we happen is that the molten steel, when they hit something that is harder, they explode. So one single drop became like a 10,000 drop.
And Arcangelo, when you are going about making these very poetic sculptures and works, how does the process begin? You know, take us inside your studio. Are you trialing and testing materials and just trying to push everything to the absolute breaking point?
First of all, the mystery of idea is that they come in my mind suddenly. As a matter of fact, I feel just a witness of my mind. So out of the blue, idea comes. And then I start with my team, with my assistant. I have a very special group of assistants. We start making experimentation, and we do in general the first experimentation inside the studio. That is the part that I love the most, to see how an idea can bloom, how can become something else. And if the idea is good, if it makes sense to go ahead with that idea, we take to a different level and we involve engineers. We test and we test and you keep discovering, which is amazing. Is always through that phrase of Picasso, I don't look for, I find. Io non cerco ma trovo. Meaning that is amazing how idea can grow, you know, for an image or your mind, then you start working on it like a flower, it grow, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, how beautiful. And Arcangelo, you know, when you are sort of developing an idea with this trusted team that you have, I mean, surely you all must have been through so much, you know. Have you had any close calls?
Completely, all the time. It's like, it's part of the experimentation, basically. And also failure is part of the experimentation. For example, here we present a work with glass. Is like a huge stone sitting on a sheet of glass, and the glass bended to its limit. And that is a kind of work that the engineer cannot calculate it. The only way to understand how much we can load the glass is breaking many glasses, basically. So it's like destroy them. So that is also another part of the work.
Yeah, incredible. And, you know, you talk about working a lot with engineers, Arcangelo. You've lived multiple professional lives. Before you were an artist, you trained as an engineer. Is that right?
Well, I have, let's say, a very unusual background because since I was a kid, I have this passion for working with my hand. It come easy for me, like, to think in three dimensional. I keep thinking in three dimensional. I see object. I go around like if my mind is a way to see around the thing. And I didn't know for many years what to do of that that passion of working with my hand until I enrolled to mechanical engineer. But I didn't attend one single day the university because at the same time I patented toys, and the toys was my it took me to New York working for a company that developed new toys. I was supposed to be there only for 3 months. I stayed there 6 years. It was an amazing experience. But in the meantime, while I was in New York, I discovered art. And from the day that I discovered art, my life changed completely. And 1 week later, I enrolled into the Academy of Art, and I moved from there.
Wow. And what art did you discover? Because when I look at your work, Arcangelo, I see a real lineage of kind of, it comes from Italian experimentation, maybe even arte programmata. And so that was very much about the kind of post-war fascination with technology, process and systems, you know, Enzo Mari, Bruno Munari. Do you have a relationship with those artists?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel belonging to the Italian tradition. And before the artists that you mentioned, I think about the futurism, then there is arte informale, then there is arte programmata, then there is like arte povera, or like a movement that are the base of the Italian art for the last century. I strongly believe that I come from that tradition. The challenge now and what an artist has to do is building from that root and move forward. So there is a tens of artists that that I love, that I study, that has been source of inspiration. And now is my turn to take all that tradition and move it forward.
Yes. And I love the way you talk about steel as a material. I mean, when we encounter steel, you listed a number of things, you know, machines, bullets. There's kind of a violence, a coldness, a functionality to them. But, you know, you're taking this source material and completely turning it on its head and finding the poetry, making it speak to philosophy. And so it's an incredible thing, I think, to be able to see something but also see new meaning and see new potential in it. And I just want to go to steel, you know, Arcangelo. You know, what is it about steel? I mean, is this something to do with your growing up in Vicenza in a kind of super industrialized part of Italy?
Well, before that, I have to tell you that during the Venice Biennial, the day after it ended, I asked the engineer to let me see the work as I had in my mind. During the biennial, the drop was going into a pool of water. But we take away the pool. I wanted the drop falling directly on the floor. And so that was fantastic because they let me do it for half an hour before he make hole on the floor. And now I'm very happy that finally here at the Mona, I can do it as I envision it.
Wow.
So to completely free the melted steel, like be liquid and explode and disappear into the dark by like 100,000 little sparkle. And yes, still belong to our life, you know, in any aspect of our life. We cannot take an aircraft, a train, a car, a boat, you know, we the fork we eat before we make the example of the ring that is a metaphor for love, or a bullet that is a metaphor for hate. So steel is still has been for like the last more than one century the spine of our life, you know, the building cannot exist without steel. So if you free the material from the solid state, but you make it to become a liquid, somehow that material became time. It represents time because he like the transformation or his like status is something that he go from one point to another. In that process, I like to think that the material became a metaphor for time. Yes, I going back to your question, yes, I grew up in the north of Italy. It's an area that is very industrial. After my experience in New York, I felt I need to go back there. And I have my studio there in Vicenza, outside Vicenza. And I like there because I can find, I have access to all kind of technology. There is like a small and bigger company that work with different technology all over the world. And for me is a great environment where to develop my work.
And Arcangelo, you know, when you were talking about finding art, you know, you quoted art, you know, art movements like Arte Povera, Arte Programmata. You know, these are artists who, you know, have a deep kind of philosophical vein. You know, they're trying to pick up the pieces of this kind of destroyed world after the World War and find a sort of a glimmer of meaning, a glimmer of hope, a glimmer of understanding. And I just want to quote you because you've said, and it's a beautiful quote, maybe mine is, at its core, a work about the open wound that is life. Can you take us deeper into this idea? What is the wound?
I think that an artist is like a filter inside a society, okay? What happened out there, the time we're living, or the time that each artist has lived, the geography, the history, the contingent, the politics that is happening out there, the design, the spirit of our time, the aesthetic of a particular time where we are living, all these elements are like unconsciously caught by the artist. And I think unconsciously, they are transforming into images, into object. And I don't believe that there is a direct translation between the final work and where it comes from. I learned that once a piece is out of your studio, it's open to all kind of a metaphor. But in my case, I feel making art is a way of make peace between the awareness of being alive and the rest of reality. You know, when we think of how wonderful and absurd is our life, you know, the only thing that makes sense for me is try to grab that condition of being alive now, and the fact that it's not forever, and transform it into an image that try to capture that fragility, that instability, that fact that nothing is forever. And with the demon and the ghost that our mind, our condition of being keep producing. And it's a constant open wound that and doesn't mean necessary to have like a negative view on life. It's just an awareness of who we are as a human being. We are like a little fiber lost in the universe, you know. I cannot believe that there is like so many egocentric out there that they want more and more and more power. For what? That condition must be hell.
Michael Doe there, talking to the Italian sculptor Arcangelo Sassolino, whose exhibition, In the End, The Beginning, is on at MONA, or the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart, until April 6. On Radio National Summer, you're listening to The Art Show. I'm Sky Kirkham, bringing you some of our best conversations. Up next, what does an artist see in their work and in the world around them? What do they bring with them to their art? And what do we take away? Michael Doe is speaking to the writer and art critic, Quinton Sprague.
To write about art is to really write about looking, about how artists meet the world, what they notice, what slips through, and what remains. In What Artists See, Quinton Sprague turns to 12 Australian artists. Artists like Sally Gabori, Simran Gill, Mike Parr. But Quinton doesn't so much as just list their works, but he lingers with how they see. What pulls at their attention? What do they uncover when the world pushes back. Quentin, who won the Prime Minister's Literary Award, puts it this way: a real artist doesn't so much create their world as uncovers it. And in reading him, you begin to wonder, when we look at art, what are we really seeing? Quentin, welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
So often art's writing, its description, its biography, its neat interpretation, but I felt that your essays, they felt maybe a little riskier, like you were trying to force language to do something more. Mm-hmm. So in publishing in this vein, tell me, is this a deliberate thing?
I think it is. I mean, it's happened organically for me as a writer, you know, simply based on my background in art, you know, and then that sort of sparking this question about what artists do and how they think about the world, right? Mm. And you learn, and you know this, Michael, as well as anyone. You've spoken to many, many sort of fantastic artists. Artists do see the world in unique and interesting ways, and often, I think there's a sort of a miscommunication about that. Things get more complicated in translation. And I think my motivation as a writer is to try and find the simple thing, even if the simple thing is, you know what, I do this, I'm motivated to do it, but I don't know what the thing is. And that's what keeps me going. Mm. And I sort of try and, find those moments where an artist admits to the mystery of the work, the driving mystery that keeps them going. And as a writer, you know, in terms of applying prose to that, it's a very sort of interesting challenge. You have a visual prompt, but it's a visual prompt that often leaves you with an unexplainable thing in the center, a thing that language can't capture, right? And I think this is the thing that keeps me returning to these sort of subjects as a writer, but it's also the thing that keeps an artist returning to the act of making, right?
And it's interesting, Quentin, that you talk about the sort of limitation of language. Mm-hmm. I know for me, as someone who loves art, when I'm in a museum or a home or in the public and I see something that I've never seen before, this gives me a feeling of sort of deep, 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 delicious excitement. But sometimes language isn't enough to kind of properly celebrate the immensity and intensity of art. Do you ever grapple with this as a writer, this sense that language, it might not be enough?
Well, I guess that's the challenge that keeps you coming back. I do think at one level, as a writer, you've got to learn to leave the work alone as well, right? You can't keep, you know, sort of banging your words against it in the hope that you will sort of somehow definitively describe it or capture its sort of conceptual underpinnings. I think the best way to do that is obliquely, right? You come at it the way that an artist comes at their subject, or a good artist, which is sort of side on, right? And, you know, there's a couple of patterns that sort of carry through this book. And one of them, you know, and these weren't sort of consciously set out, but when you gather essays together that were written over time, you begin to see the sort of the repetitions and the patterns. And one of these patterns for me is the role that place and certain places play in artists' practices. And simply by being in certain places, artists sort of learn to translate their impressions of the world into their artwork. And I'm thinking particularly of Simran Gill's relationship to her childhood home in Port Dickson in Malaysia. I'm thinking particularly of the essay, The House at Glenorie, which is about a house that the architect Glenn Murcutt built for artists Sidney Ball and Lynn Eastaway, and those artists' experience of how that house mediates that sort of quite heavy, dense bushland setting that they live and work in. But there's also other examples that run through the book as well. And I think, you know, I think there's a real slowing down that an artwork, a good artwork, engenders in us. It demands that we slow down. It demands that we look. And often I find that the artists themselves have been taught to sort of see this way through the places that they've become intimate with.
It's interesting you reference that Simran Gill essay about place because, you know, we learn about her childhood, migration, trauma, kind of chance encounters that kind of formed her worldview, her art view. But in that essay, she also talks about how artist biography should not be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought this is an interesting tension because I think when we talk about art and artists, a lot of it does encompass their identity politics, their mm-hmm. own biography, and that's a real sort of allure as a way to kind of better understand what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but at the same time, Simran is saying should not be trusted as well. Mm. So how do you navigate that tension?
Well, it is a tension, and I think it's a really key part of that essay, and it's a key part of the book in a way. You know, and as a reader, I'm interested in nonfiction work that does sort of show its hand. You know, it shows you the fallibility of even the idea of nonfiction, right? It shows you the construction that is sort of made simply by turning the stuff of real life into prose. And I think Simran's quite a literary artist. You know, she reads widely. She's a fantastic writer. And for me, that comment's quite a literary device that she's using. She's saying, look, there's a construction at play in biography and we need to acknowledge that. But the other part of that answer, Michael, is that artworks can operate on different levels, right? So an artist can give us, you know, a fairly neatly tied up set of ideas or principles that their work engages with, be that identity or politics or whatever. But the really great work does something else that's far more immutable under that sort of that kind of content. And I think the work that manages to do both things is the work that sort of really, you know, sits in a really resonant way in its time, but also extends beyond that time.
I would like to talk about a specific observation, Quinton, that you make, and that's about the tension between, you know, artists and their drive to invent mm-hmm. against the art world's demand for neat, legible and saleable works of art. And you write about Sally Gabori and how white and black paints were sometimes just set out for her because simply those were the works that sold. And this image really has stayed with me, and it's something that I find difficult to grapple with.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of support being something akin to control.
Mm.
And so where's that line, do you think, between enabling an artist and allowing them to pursue their creativity and steering them towards commerce?
Well, it's a very vexed question, and I should clarify that in that, you know, that sort of instance of black and white paint being provided in the Art Centre studio for Sally Gabori was sort of hinged around, I think, a couple of exhibitions where a dealer, I'm not sure who, had asked for black and white paintings, you know, and she was known for her use of colour and celebrated as such. But it is one of those instances, and I've worked in the Aboriginal art world as an art coordinator at an Aboriginal art centre, at two actually, and these tensions are sort of ever ready in that space, and they've been a very sort of long term interest of mine because they illuminate all sorts of other tensions in our society and in our nation, right?
Mm.
Which go back to the horror of our founding colonial act and its ramifications to this day. And what we sort of imperfectly call the remote Aboriginal art movement, which is, you know, we refer to as the art that comes out of art centres, You know, it is this kind of economy that has grown up in these places to sort of bridge a space. So there's all these misinterpretations and sort of competing ideologies that are at play in this space. And it's resulted in some absolutely fantastic and important work, but it has also resulted in these very sort of tense moments between the act of creativity and the act of commerce. And Gabori was always a very interesting example of this because she played into a number of the sort of what essentially became the tropes of the movement. But at the centre of that story and what that essay sort of does for me and what it did for me in the process of writing is draw me closer to this unavoidable fact at the centre, which is this absolutely amazing woman who had been born, you know, on a tiny island in the middle of the Gulf of Carpentaria. You know, she'd been taken off that island in her early 20s, moved to the mission on Mornington Island, and had sort of lived this life that had really begun beyond the frontier and then ended in this sort of place, you know, in our contemporary world. And drawing closer to that, you know, you begin to see like the way that a worldview, even with these kind of shaping influences on the work, there's still a worldview at the center of that. And the capacity of the artwork, however compromised or flawed, to communicate that worldview is still real. And that for me is the mystery at the center of it.
Quinton, the book reminded me about the importance of just standing, of just listening, of being open, of how to look and look in a real way, not a glance, not a passing sort of, not a passing look, but a deep looking. And so, Quinton, when you put all the works together, and it's over a decade of material here, what is it that you saw?
The thing that I began to understand was that, you know, like I've always been very open to how artists think, because I think that artists do lead the way into, you know, new ways of conceiving the world we live in, right? That's sort of the purpose of it. And I guess losing sight of that means that less people understand what art's for, right? So less people go to see it, you know. More people might go and see a blockbuster like Yayoi Kusama at the NGV, but, you know, less people might sort of wander through the permanent collections and find that one work that they keep going back to and that speaks to them, right? And that changes each time they see it and sort of begin to understand that that sort of act of looking is an act of kind of communing with something. And I think that you've sort of articulated it well when you talk about that, the slowness of that act and how the slowness of that act is now has to exist in a world that doesn't really give us many opportunities to slow down like that in a way that doesn't have to be justified, right? But I think one of the underpinning problems, it's about critical mass. It's about people actually understanding what art's for and how they can carry it into their everyday lives and live with it as a positive act, right? I think that is the thing that emerged from me. You know, like I realized that I was undertaking that kind of slow, careful looking simply by writing the essays, and that had sort of trained my eye in a certain way.
That was Michael Doe with the writer Quinton Sprague, whose book of recent essays on art and artists is called What Artists See. And that's all the time we have this week. The Art Show is produced by Tony Norton. I'm Sky Kirkham, and I'll catch you next time here on Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.